Mike Ness and Social Distortion with Bye Bye Baby from Somewhere Between Heaven and Hell. Before that, we heard the Notorious Deaf Man from the self-titled album released from Harry Boo Boo Anna Records over there in East Berlin. And that's about it for the Wrecking Hours today. It's 5:58 WHF Radio time. I'm going to leave you with one more short one from Asmodeus from Digging Up the King, released from Count Orlok Music. Here is My Dark Half. Catch you next week.
I'm in control. I'm the demon in your soul. I'll keep you alive. Then together we'll be in eternal
misery.
Join WHFR at the 20th Annual Concert of Colors, July 14th and 15th at the Max M. Fisher Center in downtown Detroit. This World Music Festival is free to attend, and WHFR will be broadcasting live from the Diversity Stage both Saturday and Sunday. With family-friendly activities, locally produced foods and goods, and music stages indoors and out, the weekend is sure to be a good one. So join us July 14th and 15th at the Max M. Fisher Center on Woodward between Warren and Mack for the 20th Annual Concert of Colors.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder, here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way
for an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit-hour Renewable Energy Certificate Program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bill, and I am your host for Common Ground, coming to you every Monday from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Join me as we travel throughout the world by music to places we've always wanted to go but could never get there for one reason or another. Once again, my name is Bill. The show is called Common Ground, every Monday, 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. right here, WHFR Radio 89.3 on the FM dial, the only station making waves.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science, interviews, and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, the amazing discovery of the Higgs boson, aka the God particle, and an underground ocean found on Saturn's moon Titan. Here's a scientist soundbite.
We have certain questions about how mass in the whole universe was generated, and in fact, a theory without a Higgs particle doesn't work at all.
That's physicist Harvey Newman. More with him later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Chris Comfort.
Archaeologists working in Guatemala have discovered a 1,300-year-old Maya text that provides only the second known reference to the so-called end date for the Maya calendar on December 21st, 2012. The researchers say the text contains no apocalyptic prophecies whatsoever connected to the date. The discovery, one of the most significant hieroglyphic finds in decades, was announced this week at the National Palace in Guatemala.
Scientists at Europe's CERN Research Center announced on July 4th that they have discovered a new subatomic particle that appears to be consistent with the Higgs boson. If verified, this long-sought-after particle, named for theoretical physicist Peter Higgs, will help scientists understand the order of the universe.
A prototype for a flying car, the Terra Fugia Transition, has successfully completed its Phase 1 flight testing. Terra Fugia says the first customer delivery of this light sport, rotable airplane should be by late 2012.
On June 29th, a violent windstorm called the Derecho advanced eastward across Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, the District of Columbia, Maryland, and in parts of New Jersey. It produced hurricane-force winds that gusted as high as 91 miles per hour in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Millions of people were left without power as trees snapped on power lines. For more information about these storms, visit earthsky.org. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Chris Comfort.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Song of the Week this week is by instrumental band My Education. It's off their upcoming album, A Drink for All My Friends. They're doing a Kickstarter campaign right now for the pre-release and to help them tour Europe. Many songs on the album are upwards of 7 minutes, so we're going to hear a shorter selection from A Drink for All My Friends.
Earth Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Physicists at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, have discovered a new particle that they're 99% certain is the long-sought Higgs boson, dubbed the God Particle. The Higgs, named after physicist Peter Higgs, is a fundamental particle of nature thought to give elementary particles their mass. On the line now to talk more about the discovery is physicist Harvey Newman of the California Institute of Technology. Dr. Newman is part of the massive international team of scientists and engineers that slam protons together at speeds close to the speed of light in order to find traces of the Higgs boson. Dr. Newman, welcome. Now, what are the latest results on the Higgs boson, also known as the God particle? Why the excitement by scientists?
We're very happy to establish a very statistically significant signal for the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson is the last missing element in the simplest standard model of particle physics, and it's also ascribed to be the source from which mass in the universe of all the elementary particles in nature are generated.
This particle has proven to be elusive, and it's required some of the most advanced, some of the biggest science facilities on the planet to try and find it. Tell us about the evidence. What's the evidence for the Higgs particle?
The standard model makes definite predictions about the production rate for such particles and also how they're seen after they're produced. What happens is what we call they decay into certain types of final particles that we measure. And there are several types of particles, several types of patterns that we can see. And the fact that we see an indication at a particular mass in several of these channels is what gives us confidence that this is a real observation. The other very important element is that the statistical significance of what we see is enough to claim an observation in common language, to claim a discovery. So the major elements in this discovery are, first of all, the Large Hadron Collider Accelerator, which is an accelerator with a circumference of about 17 miles, which spans the border of France and Switzerland under the ground, and two major experimental facilities, one called the compact muon solenoid, which is the experiment that I work on, and there's a competing experiment with a similar level of capability but a very different design called ATLAS. And both of these experiments and both of these major experimental collaborations have been able to establish this signal, this discovery.
In a nutshell, explain to us, Dr. Newman, what is the Higgs particle?
Well, the Higgs particle, as I mentioned, is the last part of the Standard Model, but it's associated, like all particles when viewed at the quantum level, it's associated with a field. And the Higgs field is believed to permeate the entire universe. And in this way, particles which are propagating through space interact with the Higgs field, and that's how they acquire their mass. This sounds exotic and far out, but actually we even observe similar phenomena in more commonplace systems. Some of the so-called solid-state or condensed matter systems, electrons are propagating in solids, sometimes behave as if they have a heavier mass, and the reason is that they interact with their surroundings.
Would you mind tying these pieces together? These Higgs particles are interacting with this field to create mass. What does this have to do with smashing particles into each other? Help us out here.
Well, with each field, there is a particle. And the thing about the Large Hadron Collider is it has enough energy and enough, let's call it intensity, what scientists call luminosity, to produce the Higgs particles at a sufficient rate for them to be observed. The reason why we had to take so much data is that the decays of the Higgs particles, whose production is relatively rare, the decays are also relatively rare. To have the distinctive pattern that we can actually pick out from all the other interactions that we create, interactions that we already understood. At the LHC, we have nearly a billion interactions of the protons per second. And we ran for a long time. So, in fact, it took hundreds of trillions of these collisions to look among those to find a small few dozen events which come from the distinctive decays of the Higgs particles to establish the signal.
And Dr. Newman, what does it mean to find this signal, to discover the Higgs particles? Why are scientists doing this?
Well, I mean, we have certain questions about how mass in the whole universe was generated. And in fact, a theory without a Higgs particle doesn't work at all. So we have a theory which is encapsulated in what's called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. It has, like other earlier basic laws of physics, like F equals ma, like Newton's laws, tremendous predictive power. And yet the first small step, is that there was a missing element, which is the Higgs particle. And so for the Standard Model to be true, there had to exist this one Higgs particle. The Higgs particle was created in the first place to explain why two of nature's four fundamental interactions, electromagnetism carried by photons and weak interaction carried by Z bosons and W bosons, known particles, can both be part of a unified theory, which was presented or discovered by theoretical physicists Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam, for which they received the Nobel Prize in 1969. This was the second theory after Feynman's quantum electrodynamics that really had tremendous predictive power in its own domain. And it was great to be able to unify two of nature's four fundamental interactions. But the question was how to have a theory that accommodates both a massless force carrier, the photon, and massive force carriers, the Z and the W bosons, in one theory that's consistent. And it was Peter Higgs and others, there's Engler, Braut, others such as Kibble, who are mentioned together, for example, in the event. There were altogether five of these theoretical founders of these ideas, with Higgs the most prominent. The question was, how in this unified electroweak theory to be able to accommodate both a massless part and a massive part? And the mechanism that he discovered in reformulating the theory left over a part of the theory, a term in the mathematics, that pointed the way to a massive particle, which is the Higgs, with a mass that's not predicted, but now we found it.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about the Higgs particle?
What I'd like people to know is that this is a generational discovery, looking into the past. Perhaps the greatest thing before this was the discovery that all matter is made up of either these light particles, like I mentioned, electrons and muons is another family, or else quarks. So this very simple picture of the building blocks of matter in a total of six small families. Looking to the future, this is just the beginning of our exploration, and the next, the present and next generation of scientists will be working to further elucidate this picture, to tell us what is behind this discovery, to answer some of our other fundamental questions which are not really answered by the standard model, and to give us a much clearer picture about how nature works and how our universe is composed.
You've been listening to physicist Harvey Newman of Caltech. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Evidence of an ocean of liquid water has been found under the surface of Saturn's icy moon Titan. That's according to research led by planetary scientist Luciano Ayes of Sapienza University in Rome, Italy. Titan might have over 10 times the amount of water on Earth, according to early estimates by Ayes. On the line in Rome to explain his findings is Luciano Ayes. Dr. Ayes, welcome.
Good morning, thank you.
Now, what are the main findings of your study investigating the possibility of liquid water on Saturn's moon Titan?
The main finding is that underneath the external icy crust of Titan, there is an underneath ocean. There is a liquid layer. The study was carried out by studying essentially the tides on Titan. Titan, we found, has very large tides, so large that if Titan, that exclude the possibility that Titan is made up by solids, only by solids, for example, rock and ice. There must be underneath the surface a liquid layer which decouples the rocks, which are at the interior, from the external icy layer.
Dr. Ayes, please talk about the evidence here. You mentioned the Cassini spacecraft. This is NASA's Cassini spacecraft has sent over some amazing images of moons and of planets in our solar system. Talk more. What is the strongest evidence of this amazing discovery that Saturn's moon Titan has a liquid ocean?
Well, the evidence comes from the fact that Titan experiences large tides. And we have seen these tides by looking at the tidal changes that the Cassini spacecraft experiences when it passes by Titan. Essentially, when Titan has a large tide in a certain direction, this affects the orbit of the Cassini spacecraft, and we have measured these changes. So, as I said earlier, if Titan were completely solid, the tides, one would have expected tides not larger than 1 meter. Well, we have seen tidal deformations which correspond to about 10 meters, so very large. And they are so large that only a liquid layer underneath, below the icy shell, can explain them.
And Dr. Ayes, please compare the tides on Saturn's moon Titan to the tides that people are familiar with here on Earth. I mean, here on Earth, we have a liquid ocean at the surface. We could see these tides. What are these tides like on Titan?
All of us are well familiar with ocean tides because we see the sea level rising and falling. However, most people don't know that the ground on which our houses are built, we are sitting, etc., also goes up and down by about, let us say, a couple of feet, 1-2 feet, twice a day. These tides are called the solid tides, and they affect the entire crust of the Earth. And they are made possible by the fact that the core of the Earth is liquid. Pretty much the same principle which generates the tides on Titan. So on Titan, the outer shell is solid because it's ice, but this icy shell moves up and down, pumped by the liquid which is underneath. And pretty much the same phenomenon occurs on the Earth because we have a core which is made up by molten iron and nickel, and this molten core pumps the crust up and down.
You know, just to compare this, I guess, to Earth, I mean, I've seen one report that compares the water on Earth to what is possible on Titan, 10 times as much water on Titan as there is on Earth.
That's more or less correct, yes, it's true.
Now, step back for a second for us and tell us a little bit about why scientists are doing this. Why are scientists looking for water on other worlds like Titan?
The search of water has been one of the main goals of planetary exploration because, of course, water is always linked to the possibility of life. However, of course, the equation water equal to life is completely wrong. So we cannot say that there is life because we have found water. Absolutely not. But, of course, it's very difficult to think to life without water. The presence of water tells us many things about the interior structure of the body and also about its thermal history, how Titan is formed.
You've been listening to planetary scientist Luciano Ayes. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, My Education, The Echocentrics, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But what we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't, what you don't know.
Hi, this is Steve Levitt.
And I'm Stephen Dubner. Thanks for downloading this Freakonomics Radio podcast.
When we started this a couple years ago, I never imagined we would still be making podcasts 2 years later.
And to your great chagrin or to your great joy, we are?
Well, you do all the work, so it's no problem for me.
Yeah, people think that you spend a lot of time in the radio studio, though.
Let's keep it that way. It doesn't hurt me to have them thinking I'm busy in the radio studio.
Well, division of labor-wise, you know, I do pick your brain a lot.
Yeah, that's easy. I just don't want to have to go places, talk to strangers, things like that.
Yeah, you don't like talking to strangers too much, do you?
Whenever we're together, I'm so glad that you're doing the talking, so I can just mind my own business.
Levitt, what is your favorite thing about doing this podcast?
That you do all the work.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So it's time for another round of FAQs, frequently asked questions, where we answer queries from you, our listeners and readers, and we've got Steve Levitt on the line.
Hey, Dubner.
You really love these, don't you? I mean, it is incredibly fun to have people write with real questions, isn't it?
Yeah, because the questions we get are so strange that you never could have made them up.
What do you think it says about just the age we live in where anybody can find anybody and write to them? Because like in the old days, you know, I used to have crazy questions for authors whose books I read and you know, you couldn't get to them. But now everybody's got our email. You like that idea?
Yeah, you know, the nice thing about email is that it's a high cost for the sender and it's a low cost for the receiver. Like compared to, say, talking on the phone, where if somebody calls you and you talk to them, it costs the initiator and the recipient the same amount of time and effort. But if someone wants to go and spend 20 minutes writing an email, we can respond in 30 seconds. That's not a bad trade-off.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. If someone wants to write an email to you or to us and have a good chance of having it be answered, not necessarily on this podcast, but just, you know, via email or whatever, give people some guidelines. What are the topics or the approaches that you are going to consider worth answering?
The hard part, I think, is just getting us to open the email, right? Because there's just so much stuff and you cull through. And so having a good tagline, a clever tagline that piques our interest, I think, is good. Short definitely helps. Long is terrible.
Yeah.
Because you have a theory about books. If you don't get to the end of a book, you will never recommend it to anyone.
That is my theory.
If you don't get to the end of an email, you can't possibly reply.
That is true. Yeah, I do have this theory about books, and I have no idea if it's true because I've looked for data and it's really hard to find. But my view is that, you know, the way that books work best is when you read something and love it and tell someone else about it. And I find that I don't often tell people about books that I read 10 pages of, even though I do that. What about you? Do you finish a lot of books and then tell people about it versus reading a bit and telling people?
Well, I'm not a big finisher, that's for sure, on books. I'm a good starter and a bad finisher.
What share of books that you that come into your possession, either through gift or purchase or whatever, stealing, what share of books that come into your possession do you finish, would you say?
Oh, I'd say ones that I actively go out and ones get myself out.
Ones that you start to read, let's say. Forget about ones that you get them in the mail. Books that you start to read, what share do you finish, would you say?
I'd say 5 or 10%, but yeah. I don't really think most books are meant to be read. Most books have so little content that they say the same thing over and over and over. And so unless you're kind of slow, there's no point in reading chapters 7, 8, 9, 10 because they just say the same thing over and over. Now, that's not true of all books, but certainly most business books. Now, obviously, history books are
novels,
yeah.
Yeah.
Novels you got to finish. So I do, you know, probably I finish half my novels.
Well, you love kind of teenage girl novels. That's kind of your favorite genre.
I know. The Hunger Games is next on my list. I haven't had a chance to get to that yet.
Yeah. What are like your favorite series ever in history? Twilight would be number one, you think?
No, I know. Harry Potter was way better than Twilight. Uh-huh. I kind of had a love, you know, I had a love-hate relationship with the Twilight series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You ever
I was obsessed with them.
You ever read any romance?
No, I never have. Not really my thing.
Yeah. I haven't either, although I've been reading so much about people who read romance now because the ebook facilitates it, because you don't have to carry the, you know, the bodice ripper cover isn't on the cover anymore.
Right.
And so it did make me curious. I almost downloaded one the other day just to read it, but I was somehow afraid that, like, I have a shared Kindle account with my wife and kids. And I didn't know what that would lead to. okay, so let's look at some questions from readers, listeners. Here's one from Andrew Foster. Andrew writes, "Dear Freakonomics, I have been listening to your podcast, and I just started reading your book. You had a podcast about the lotto, the lottery, and savings accounts. That these were these prize-linked savings accounts that we did a piece about how you can encourage people to save money and still get a lottery payout by pooling their interest and giving them some." And he writes, "With the 84-year-old woman who won the lottery in your episode, it got me wondering, what would you guys do with those winnings?"
Dubner, you know how to spend money. What would you do with the lottery winnings?
Why do you say I know how to spend money?
You live in New York, fancy upstate New York trips. And
fancy,
you know,
upstate New York trips. Like driving into the woods. So I have a little bit of a problem spending money on myself. Sometimes I do, but I have no problem spending money on my family. That's the one thing I would say. So if I had a lot of money, a lot more money, I mean, I feel like I have enough money. But if I had a lot more, I'd probably spend more on my family. On the other hand, I don't know. They kind of have what they need.
For me, because I don't really want – you know me. I don't want anything.
You have simple tastes.
I don't like fancy cars.
Yeah.
The only thing I can imagine collecting other than wanting to have a private jet, which I would want just because the thing I would love to buy if someone were selling it is time, because time's the thing that I'm shortest on. And a private jet I see as a way of buying a lot of time when I travel, not having to fight the airports and the schedules and just being able to go where I want to go.
Also, you wouldn't have to see any other people because that's kind of your thing, right?
Yeah, that would be good too. But I, you know what would be hard, though, is then there'd be a pilot and me. It would just be like a bad cab ride then when you feel like you got to talk to the pilot.
Well,
there's a lot of people you don't have to talk to when there's only a couple of you. Feel
yeah,
like
but
you gotta,
he's busy.
To.
Fine. He or
he's
she.
He's busy. Yeah.
Actually,
wait,
you know who your pilot would be. If you got a private plane, do you know who your pilot would be?
It would be your brother.
My brother, Joe Dubner, who's the world's greatest pilot, who's looking for
exactly.
a job flying planes.
He's not a talker like you, though, is he?
He is so not. You would love him. He does.
Oh,
he's
great.
Very quiet.
Okay. Well, he's got the job if I can just win the lottery then. There's one other thing that I would collect if I had tons and tons of money would probably be memberships at fancy golf clubs,
mm-hmm.
which would never, ever make sense to do if you didn't have much money because I wouldn't really ever use them. But if I were purely living a life of indulgence and luxury, it would involve flying my private jet to Augusta or some fancy place to play golf from time to time.
Well, that leads very nicely into another question here from someone named Patricia, who says, "Dear Dubner and Levitt, I have a very simple question. What are your current obsessions?" So I have to say, I am obsessed with how obsessed you are with golf. That is my obsession.
Yeah,
I love – you are – you're nuts, Levitt. I mean, let's face it.
I do love golf. I love golf more than any normal person could. But the funny thing about obsessions like golf is they're only fun when you have a nice job and a good family. I've learned that if all I had was golf, I'd certainly want to kill myself because golf is a painful, cruel, unpleasant, constant reminder of how terrible you are at something. And I think you need to have a good grounding to be obsessed with it.
I'm curious, do you think that you love golf so much in part because time is relatively scarce? You know, you're busy, you got a family, you work, et cetera, and golf is very time consuming so that it's kind of the time scarcity means that when you get to do golf, it feels more precious as opposed to having nothing else to do but golf. It would be not so much fun.
No, I think I love golf because I really wanted to be good at it as a kid, and I completely and totally failed. And much of my adult life has been devoted to trying to undo the mistakes I made as a child. And so the reason I've come to love golf so much is that I have had just the tiniest little bit of success but not very much, in undoing my failings of it as a child. And so it just is the worst kind of addictive on and off feedback, which drags you deeper and deeper into it. And it also has this incredible attraction to me that while it's physical, at the same time, it's incredibly intellectual, that trying to understand, you know, whether it's the physics of the swing or just the mapping between what happens in your head and what actually is going on when you look at it on video, I find it incredibly enticing and so measurable as well. I love the measurement. So it's almost fiendishly designed to tap into every one of my quirks and make me obsessed with it.
Coming up, how do you make an economist happy? That's easy. Steal his car.
Instead of the dread that most people have about, oh no, my car's not going to be here, I think, oh my, this would be awesome.
And how to eat like a freak.
My tastes go to things like
KFC,
beef jerky,
Chipotle,
Grape Crush,
dill pickles,
chicken wings. I love chicken wings.
You do love your chicken wings.
Freakonomics Radio explores the hidden side of everything. Sponsoring the Freakonomics podcast could help nearly a million listeners a week discover your business. Email us at sponsorship@wnyc.org.
From WNYC and APM American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Welcome back to Frequently Asked Questions, where Steve Levitt and I answer queries from you, our listeners and readers. All right, let's here's a question from a Jeffrey Summersill. Jeffrey Summersill writes to say, being in the aerial application business, parenthesis crop dusting, it amazes me how much and all the different kinds of insurance we carry. Of course, this holds true to life, homeowners, auto, health, income, warranties, etc. Just because you have insurance does not always mean you're covered. So my question is, what would the world be like without insurance? Would we be better off or worse? Would people take more care or own junk? What effect does having insurance have on society? So, Levitt, what do you think? I mean, how many different kinds of insurance do you think you own?
I have the absolute minimum insurance. Mm-hmm. I think insurance is greatly – the value of insurance is greatly exaggerated in almost all cases. Many people, I think, don't understand the purpose of insurance. The purpose of insurance, to an economist, is to shift money to – what we call states of the world in which money has a lot of value relative to other states of the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me try to say that. That was like
Yeah, it was good though.
Okay, so before your house burns down, if you have a dollar, it's not worth as much to you as after your house burns down, right? So if you could magically find a way to trade a dollar before your house burns down for a dollar after your house burns down, you'd want to put more money in the after the house burns down category. This is a world of no insurance, so that you could buy all the stuff that got burned down in your house. Okay, and that is the purpose of insurance. It's a way of moving around money so that you have it when you need it, not when you don't need it.
So why do you think so many people carry – well, I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of insurance, and some of it we have to carry. So right now, you know, there's a debate about the healthcare mandate and people being forced, quote, forced to own healthcare insurance, which is a big issue. On the other hand, if you want to drive a car, you have to have insurance, right?
Right. So that's to protect other people. So the idea is you have insurance so that when you smash your car into other people, someone will be compensated for it. Healthcare, I mean, there's good reasons to have healthcare insurance for catastrophic things. Healthcare can be incredibly expensive, and it makes sense to be able to, in a pinch, have someone pay for incredibly expensive things that you can't really afford. But the thing that people, I think, forget about insurance is that it's not free to administer, right? There's some big insurance company somewhere with a big fancy headquarters, which is paying for all of the workers and all of the, you know, the advertising by charging more for the insurance than it costs them to actually pay out the claims. And so unless you got a good reason to need the kind of coverage, the protection against something catastrophic, you just have to understand that people aren't doing this out of the kindness of their heart providing insurance. They're doing it with a profit motive. And so it's
– And the insurance business model, I think a lot of people don't really get it. And maybe I don't get it either. But from what I see, from what I know, the insurance business model is essentially we sell you, obviously, what this thing that we call insurance, where you give us money now on the chances that we might have to give you a bunch of money later if situation X happens, and we've calculated the probability of situation X and we know we're going to charge enough. But as they're taking in the money now, what the insurance business is really about is investing, right? I mean, that's what insurance companies do, is they take in your money and then invest it and make more money. And that's essentially where their profits come from, yes?
Yeah, exactly.
So do you think that if people understood that that's the way the insurance business essentially works, that they'd be a little bit less eager to give money to insurance companies?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more fun. I think it's really – I know you're obsessed with financial literacy, and I think this is a case where there's a general idea that's been passed on in our society that insurance is a good thing, that you should be insured, that you should be protected against losses. And people don't actually understand why they should get insurance. They just have been told they should, and they kind of understand that it feels good when you lose something to get paid back.
Well, do you think it's connected to the theme we've talked about a lot of times, which is that we tend to really exaggerate not only the likelihood but kind of the pain caused by anomalous events that turn out to be bad, which are pretty rare and often not as damaging as we think, that people just kind of overscare themselves into buying a lot of insurance?
Yeah, I think people imagine it would be really, really awful if their car got stolen. Right? And it would be bad, right? And it would be the equivalent of, say, you got a $20,000 car. Well, you're $20,000 poor. So the question is, does it really change my life if I have my car stolen? If it really changes your life, then I think you should have insurance. But you hit on something important, which is that people are very bad judges of what their how they'll feel in the future. So I tell you, one of the best investments I made in the insurance domain was in buying LoJack.
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, and our readers may know, LoJack is a little hidden transmitter you put inside of in the hood of your car, or they put in the hood of your car. And then if your car gets stolen, then you're able to track it. Okay. Now, most people get LoJack because it's both you get a deduction off your insurance, and also it's a way of getting your car back when it's stolen. And what I hadn't anticipated when I got LoJack, but what I eventually came to understand, is that the real reason to get LoJack is it makes you want your car to get stolen. So every time I, say, parked on a different level of the parking lot and got confused and couldn't find my car, instead of the dread that most people have about, oh, no, my car's not going to be here, I think, oh, my, this would be awesome. God, I hope my car gets stolen. You know, we'll release the hounds and see what happens as we go, you know, on the chase to get the car back. So that, to me, was the best kind of insurance I ever had, because it transformed an experience, which is in general a very negative one, into one which was actually a positive. And that's something that it's hard for insurance to do generally.
Levitt, here's a note from a reader named Mary Wiseman, who says, "My daughter bought your book because of the, quote, funny title, end quote, and has read sections to us, her father and me, in the car and at home. She's 16. Goodness, what a nerd. So I was thinking that I want to have your book as my book club choice. What I would like to know is what you think the perfect meal is to match up with your book at our book club discussion." Ooh. Apples, oranges, I guess, is the fruit salad you start with, and apple teenies. But holy cow. Levitt, you have any thoughts on a Freakonomics-themed meal?
You know, I'm embarrassed to say that after she sent this email, I spent a lot of time trying to think of the answer. So I was trying to think different angles. But, you know, I mean, the apple orange is an obvious, a good one. I can't miss, for at least visually. But so I think, well, we don't really talk about food. So kangaroo burgers would be good if you're doing Super Freak, because we talk about the virtues of those for global warming.
Because we should just explain, because, you know, red meat is very greenhouse gas intensive, in part because animals that chew their own cud, ruminants, exhale a lot of methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, and kangaroos do not. So kangaroo burgers versus hamburgers, very good for the environment on the scale that it can be. So, yeah. Okay, kangaroo burgers, apples, oranges.
Okay, so after that, I think, well, maybe the right tribute would be to eat some of our favorite foods. And she could say, yeah, we talked to the authors, and that's what we said. So, you know, my tastes go to things like
KFC.
KFC, beef jerky.
Chipotle.
Grape Crush. Mm-hmm. So I think you couldn't really go wrong with fast food. Chicken wings. I love chicken wings.
You do love your chicken wings. Hey, so how about this? How about she has a potluck supper where everybody brings a food, and then each one has a pay-as-you-wish for each food. And then you could really determine, you know, I guess the appetite and value of each person's contribution.
You know, the potluck is so anti-Freakonomics.
So you think what do you mean then? They'd have to be assigned what they're bringing?
No. People shouldn't bring stuff. That's so why? Oh. It's anti-Freakonomics in the sense that, number one, it's got this huge free rider problem that you're making stuff for everybody else. The other thing is it's so inefficient for individuals to make their own food.
Mm.
Right? So the only sensible thing to do is to call someone who's good at making food, like a restaurant, and have the restaurant do it. I mean, we have potlucks at school, at my kid's school. The only thing worth eating is KFC. You know, as soon as somebody brings KFC because they're too lazy to cook something, it disappears. I mean, it's so inefficient to have people make food at home. I mean, obviously, there's a social component, whatever, but it's total. That's potluck, totally anti-Freakonomics. Can't do that.
Did people frown on the KFC at your kid's school potluck?
Yeah, they frowned on it as they wiped the grease stains off of their the sides of their mouth and pretended they didn't eat it.
Uh-huh.
Actually, to be honest, we slipped it in there real fast so no one could see that's what we brought.
I had a feeling it might have been.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, Catherine Wells, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes and go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
I'm a woman with chronic schizophrenia. I've spent hundreds of days in psychiatric hospitals. I might have ended up spending most of my life on the back ward of a hospital, but that isn't how my life turned out. In fact, I've managed to stay clear of hospitals for almost 3 decades, perhaps my proudest accomplishment. That's not to say that I've remained clear of all psychiatric struggles. After I graduated from the Yale Law School and got my first law job, my New Haven analyst, Dr. White, announced to me that he was going to close his practice in 3 months, several years before I had planned to leave New Haven. White had been enormously helpful to me, and the thought of his leaving shattered me. My best friend, Steve, sensing that something was terribly wrong, flew out to New Haven to be with me. Now I'm going to quote from some of my writings. I opened the door to my studio apartment. Steve would later tell me that for all the times he had seen me psychotic, nothing could have prepared him for what he saw that day. For a week or more, I had barely eaten. I was gaunt. I walked as though my legs were wooden. My face looked and felt like a mask. I had closed all the curtains in the apartment, so in the middle of the day, the apartment was in near total darkness. The air was fetid, the room a shambles. Steve, both a lawyer and a psychologist, has treated many patients with severe mental illness, and to this day, he'll say I was as bad as any he had ever seen. Hi, I said, and then I returned to the couch where I sat in silence for several moments. Thank you for coming, Steve. Crumbling world, word, voice, tell the clocks to stop. Time has come. White is leaving, Steve said somberly. I'm being pushed into a grave. The situation is grave, I moan. Gravity is pulling me down. I'm scared. Tell them to get away. As a young woman, I was in a psychiatric hospital on three different occasions for lengthy periods. My doctors diagnosed me with chronic schizophrenia and gave me a prognosis of, quote, grave. That is, at best, I was expected to live in a board and care and work at menial jobs. Fortunately, I did not actually enact that grave prognosis. Instead, I'm a chaired professor of law, psychology, and psychiatry at the USC Gould School of Law. I have many close friends, and I have a beloved husband, Will, who's here with us today. Thank you. He's definitely the star of my show. I'd like to share with you how that happened and also describe my experience of being psychotic. I hasten to add that it's my experience because everyone becomes psychotic in his or her own way. Let's start with the definition of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a brain disease. Its defining feature is psychosis or being out of touch with reality. Delusions and hallucinations are hallmarks of the illness. Delusions are fixed and false beliefs that aren't responsive to evidence, and hallucinations are false sensory experiences. For example, when I'm a psychotic, I often have the delusion that I've killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts. I sometimes have the idea that nuclear explosions are about to be set off in my brain. Occasionally, I have hallucinations, like one time I turned around and saw a man with a raised knife. Imagine having a nightmare while you're awake. Often, speech and thinking become disorganized to the point of incoherence. Loose associations involves putting together words that may sound a lot alike but don't make sense. And if the words get jumbled up enough, it's called word salad. Contrary to what many people think, schizophrenia is not the same as multiple personality disorder or split personality. The schizophrenic mind is not split, but shattered. Everyone has seen a street person, unkempt, probably ill-fed, standing outside of an office building, muttering to himself or shouting. This person is likely to have some form of schizophrenia. But schizophrenia presents itself across a wide array of socioeconomic status, and there are people with the illness who are full-time professionals with major responsibilities. Several years ago, I decided to write down my experiences and my personal journey, and I want to share some more of that story with you today to convey the inside view. So the following episode happened the seventh week of my first semester of my first year at Yale Law School, quoting from my writings. My two classmates, Rebel and Val, and I had made the date to meet in the law school library on Friday night to work on our memo assignment together, but we didn't get far before I was talking in ways that made no sense. Memos are visitations, I informed them. They make certain Dr. Martyr, a schizophrenia expert who was following me for medication side effects. He was under the impression that I had a mild psychotic illness. Once in his office, I sat on his couch, folded over, and began muttering. Head explosions and people trying to kill. Is it okay if I totally trash your office? You need to leave if you think you're going to do that, said Martyr. Okay, small, fire on ice. Tell them not to kill me. Tell them not to kill me. What have I done wrong? Hundreds of thousands with thoughts, interdiction. Ellen, do you feel like you're dangerous to yourself or others? I think you need to be in the hospital. I could get you admitted right away and the whole thing could be very discreet. Ha, ha, ha. You're offering to put me in hospitals? Hospitals are bad. They're mad. They're sad. One must stay away. I'm God, or I used to be. At that point in the text where I said, I'm God, or I used to be, my husband made a marginal note. He said, did you quit or were you fired? I give life and I take it away. Forgive me, for I know not what I do. Eventually, I broke down in front of friends, and everybody convinced me to take more medication. I could no longer deny the truth, and I could not change it. The wall that kept me, Ellen, Professor Sachs, separate from that insane woman hospitalized years past, lay smashed in ruins. Everything about this illness says I shouldn't be here, but I am, and I am, I think, for three reasons. First, I've had excellent treatment. 4 to 5 day a week psychoanalytic psychotherapy for decades and continuing, and excellent psychopharmacology. Second, I have many close family members and friends who know me and know my illness. These relationships have given my life a meaning and a depth, and they also help me navigate my life in the face of symptoms. Third, I work at an enormously supportive workplace at USC Law School. This is a place that not only accommodates my needs, but actually embraces them. It's also a very intellectually stimulating place, and occupying my mind with complex problems has been my best and most powerful and most reliable defense against my mental illness. Even with all that, excellent treatment, wonderful family and friends, supportive work environment, I did not make my illness public until relatively late in life. And that's because the stigma against mental illness is so powerful that I didn't feel safe with people knowing. If you hear nothing else today, please hear this. There are not schizophrenics. There are people with schizophrenia. And these people may be your spouse, they may be your child, they may be your neighbor, they may be your friend, they may be your coworker. So let me share some final thoughts. We need to invest more resources into research and treatment of mental illness. The better we understand these illnesses, the better the treatments we can provide, and the better the treatments we can provide, the more we can offer people care and not have to use force. Also, we must stop criminalizing mental illness. It's a national tragedy and scandal that the LA County Jail is the biggest psychiatric facility in the United States. American prisons and jails are filled with people who suffer from severe mental illness, and many of them are there because they never received adequate treatment. I could have easily ended up there or on the streets myself. A message to the entertainment industry and to the press. On the whole, you've done a wonderful job fighting stigma and prejudice of many kinds. Please continue to let us see characters in your movies, your plays, your columns who suffer with severe mental illness. Portray them sympathetically and portray them in all the richness and depth of their experience as people and not as diagnoses. Recently, a friend posed a question. If there were a pill I could take that would instantly cure me, would I take it? The poet Rainer Maria Rilke was offered psychoanalysis. He declined, saying, "Don't take my devils away because my angels may flee too." My psychosis, on the other hand, is a waking nightmare in which my devils are so terrifying that all my angels have already fled. So would I take the pill in an instant? That said, I don't wish to be seen as regretting the life I could have had if I'd not been mentally ill, nor am I asking anyone for their pity. What I rather wish to say is that the humanity we all share is more important than the mental illness we may not. What those of us who suffer with mental illness want is what everybody wants. In the words of Sigmund Freud, to work and to love. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Very kind. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Join WHFR at the 20th Annual Concert of Colors, July 14th and 15th at the Max M. Fisher Center in downtown Detroit. This World Music Festival is free to attend, and WHFR will be broadcasting live from the Diversity Stage both Saturday and Sunday. With family-friendly activities, locally produced foods and goods, and music stages indoors and out, the weekend is sure to be a good one. So join us July 14th and 15th at the Max M. Fisher Center on Woodward between Warren and Mac for the 20th Annual Concert of Colors.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at Autism Speaks.